General Downward, Reel 1. Could you tell me why it was that you converted from flying gliders to flying powered aircraft?
Well, first of all the glider pilots had been trained on propeller-driven aircraft in their training, and some of us had gone on to some more advanced aircraft, so we had a sort of an engined flight capability. But after 1950, the glider pilot regiment, or the role of the glider pilot regiment, was obviously in sight, and the glider pilot regiment ran down to one squadron, an independent squadron comprising five officers and about 32 pilots, NCO pilots. In that year, of course, the Korean War started, and the Commonwealth Divisional Commander, General Jim Castles, had realized that, looking across the Corps front, I think, and seeing his American neighbors, that they had a large number of light aircraft assisting him in the role, in the sort of battlefield surveillance, immediately summoned one flight, which was a Gunner Aero P flight, 1903, from Hong Kong, and then asked if he could have another flight of aircraft to do a similar role to the American aircraft, and it was to do reconnaissance and general purpose duties, perhaps air staff car work, sort of taking sort of VIPs back to sort of Corps or back to Army and so forth. And this was put to the glider pilot regiment. As we'd all been engine trained, it was no great difficulty for us to convert straight away onto the Austers. And so the role was set in early 51 for us to form a flight which was to be called 1913 Light Liaison Flight. How that name came about, I don't know, but anyway, it was a liaison flight, and we formed it in June 1951, and we carried out training in North Wales, which was considered to be to have some territory and some physical contours similar to the type of land we might find in Korea, and we then formed the flight. We were joined by quite a large number of RAF ground crew who were to be responsible for the maintenance of the aircraft, and we then put everything together at Middle Wallop, and the flight set sail in August 51.
Why was it that the gliders were actually run down?
I think that the main thing was that the role of the towed aircraft, the combination was obviously so slow. We were then seeing jet aircraft, particularly sort of jet fighter aircraft and interceptors, coming into being in the various air forces of the world, particularly the Americans and ourselves. And it was very obvious that the use of these very slow and cumbersome combinations lumbering into battle really had no future. The last battle which they went into, of course, was the Rhine crossing, and the casualties were fairly heavy there, but that was mainly due to ground fire from the German air-cact defences. But the end of the glider pilot regiment was quite obviously in sight even before 1950. It was kept together as a cadre, and then with the start of this 1913 light liaison flight, that was more or less the end of the glider pilot regiment as a glider flying role.
From the point of view of pure pilot art, which did you prefer, the glider or the powered aircraft?
That's an interesting point, because there were two very different techniques. Flying the glider was quite a heavy physical effort. You had to have two pilots, first of all. You more or less flew the glider, the Horsa glider, by brute force and ignorance, by both hands, both feet, going at the same time. And you had to have quite a good judgment from the point of view of the load you were carrying, the direction of the wind when you were landing, the force of the wind, and of course assessing the ground from a height of perhaps no more than about 2,000 feet, which didn't give you much time to assess the ground. So flying behind the tug was fairly straightforward. Carrying out a landing with a glider, particularly on an unknown landing ground, could be fairly hazardous. So there was a certain amount of thrill and excitement in flying, of course, a glider. Switching now to the Aero P-type aircraft, the Auster, that was much more satisfying to fly it as an individual. You were entirely your own master in the aircraft. You were responsible for piloting the aircraft, navigating the aircraft, and of course, as we found later when we went to Korea, very much responsible for the actual observation over the forward areas, assessing the enemy position, so forth, in relation to our own troops. And this, to me, became the most fascinating part of my flying experience, was really flying over the top of our own troops and giving support.
You mentioned the Horsa. What about the Hamilcar? Was that the same?
Yes, the Hamilcar was, of course, was the tank-carrying glider. It used to carry a tank, the Tetrarch tank, which was about 8.5 tons. A very heavy aircraft to fly. Again, it had to have two pilots. These were in tandem, sitting up on top of the Hamilcar. I was with a squadron, although I wasn't actually Hamilcar trained, but I did fly as second pilot on the Hamilcars on two or three occasions. There was no doubt about it, it was a very difficult aircraft to fly and required a lot of experience. One of the main difficulties was that when you were flying in that position, sitting up on top of the Hamilcar glider, you'd got the wings either side of you, and it was very difficult to see down to the ground to be able to assess your actual sort of touchdown point and to make an assessment of the landing zone. But effective in battle, they carried the light tank, which was nothing much more than a sort of a mobile pillbox. But nevertheless, they did take quite an active part in Normandy. Arnhem, of course, as well, and latterly, the last battle really was the Rhine crossing.
Was the Auster easy to fly?
Yes, it was. There's little doubt about it, I think, by present-day standards, with the tremendous training that goes into flying, not only RAF aircraft and Royal Naval aircraft, but the modern army aircraft are very sophisticated indeed. Many of them, of course, are now helicopters. But first of all, it was a fairly simple but very rugged engine, a de Havilland engine. It was a fabric covered aircraft, pretty light. The controls were simple, and it was a very reliable aircraft. Short landing, short takeoff, very maneuverable at low level. And it was an aircraft which I thoroughly enjoyed flying. I think all of us did. There was one other aircraft which we also flew out there, which was on loan to us, which I'll tell you about later. It was the Cessna L-19, which was the American opposite number to it. But again, a very pleasant aircraft to fly. The main thing, really, of course, with a high-wing monoplane, as was the case with the Auster and with the Cessna L-19, that you had perfect observation down below. There was nothing to obstruct your view whatever.
You mentioned that you were sent off to Wales because it was supposed to resemble Korean terrain. Were the flying conditions in Wales similar to those in Korea?
I think the climatic conditions at the time of the year when we trained were very different to what we were to find in Korea. It was interesting. It was good practice for us to be able to fly down valleys and round mountains and hills, which were devoid of, in many areas in North Wales, were devoid of any form of metal road, so you really had to sort of navigate according to features rather than line features. And this was similar to Korea, because there were very few roads, although there were mainly tracks, which had probably been sort of hacked out of paddy fields by the United Nations armies. And, of course, the odd river line, the Imjin being the principal one, which was our main sort of focal point in Korea. Climatic conditions. We actually trained during the summer months in Wales, mainly North Wales, flying around sort of the Snowdon area and sort of areas, mountainous areas further south of that. But the weather conditions were pretty well perfect the whole of the time. When we went to Korea, of course, as we expected, weather conditions were extremely cold, and in the summer months could be extremely hot. So quite often you got severe turbulence in both the cold weather and the hot weather, which made observation very difficult, particularly if you were using binoculars. And this was something which we were to develop later as a technique, the style of observation which we used in battle conditions, flying in adverse weather, and also, of course, keeping clear of our own artillery.
Did you do much tactical training while you were flying around Wales? Did they put out camouflaged objects for you to try and spot and locate on a map, that sort of thing?
In the training, no. There wasn't a great deal of time for sort of the tactical training, although we had a technique which was very much on the similar lines, on the same lines as the AeroP training, and that was that one never sort of did a direct approach to a sort of landing zone from a sort of a height where one might be observed. One had to do what was called a concealed approach. So perhaps you might overfly the landing zone, and you would see nothing whatever. Perhaps a chap would come out and put out a marker T. Once you'd seen it, you'd perhaps waggle your wings or, in fact, sort of give an indication that you'd seen it, and then sort of fly on. The T would be removed, and you'd then do a sort of a long, fairly low-level approach to it and put the aircraft down first time. Looking for targets and looking for sort of other sort of forms of intelligence on the ground, as far as I can remember, we were merely sort of... We did work out some exercises and brought back information on what we found at certain grid references, but there was still a lot to learn when we got to Korea in the way of tactical flying and particularly tactical observation.
Who was training you when you were in Wales?
The training was done at Middle Wallop, and most of the instructors were Army instructors who had qualified at the Royal Air Force Central Flying School. The chief instructor was Royal Air Force, a squadron leader, and there were one or two others of RAF instructors there. It was a complete mixture, but the actual piloting and sort of flying instruction was carried out under the aegis of the Royal Air Force, because Middle Wallop was a Royal Air Force station, but most of the actual pilot instructors were Army officers. Most of them were, at that time, were gunner captains.
What sort of altitude would you be flying at normally?
In battle conditions, we were taught that we were to fly at low level most of the time and never expected to go much above about 1,000 feet. That was purely to observe. We used to fly at low level, and this was very much on the lines of the AeroP tactical flying, fly at low level and suddenly rise up to about 300 to 400 feet, observe the target, and particularly observing the shot of our own guns to see where they fell, and then sort of go down and resume sort of low-level flying again. That was keeping out of the sight of sort of enemy aircraft and enemy ground fire. But we found that this wasn't quite the sort of technique which was needed in Korea. First of all, that there wasn't a great deal of anti-aircraft fire against us at low level, and there was practically no enemy aircraft activity in the forward areas, or in the actual sort of the line of the forward defence localities. But rising to 1,000 feet, the danger then came that you were then getting in the way of the our own guns' trajectories. So it was either fly low down, usually below 500 feet, and keeping well away from the guns, or get right up high and get over the top of the trajectories. With the 25 pounders, it was about, I think we always reckoned if we were above 3,700 feet, we were probably safe. But the main difficulty then was that if we suddenly heard our own artillery call up for support, extra support from us, of the American medium and heavy guns, the 105s, and some larger field guns which they had, that we then knew that we were in the way, so we had to get out of the way quickly.
How short a runway could you land on?
Depending on weather conditions, but taking it as being still air, that we would normally reckon we would need a strip of about 300 yards was probably about the maximum. We were taught, in fact, to land in much smaller spaces than that. We could land in about 150 yards, but when we used to ask the sappers to bulldoze a strip for us, which, after all, were just mud paddy grounds, really, or paddy fields, which have been sort of bulldozed flat and filled in with a certain amount of hardcore, we used to ask for about 300 yards, if they could give us that. But there were occasions, and there were many other strips, which were probably down to about 150 yards, which we could land on quite comfortably. But it wasn't so much the landing, it was the difficulty of getting off again, particularly if you were to pick up a passenger or something like that. But 300 yards was about the average.
So 300 yards was okay for takeoff? 300 yards was adequate for takeoff?
Yes. Yes, 300 yards was adequate for takeoff. And again, of course, it depended on wind. If you've got a severe crosswind, which you obviously sometimes did get in Korea, some very heavy crosswinds, that had to be borne in mind, that you had to have a little bit of extra length there. And what we sometimes had to do was that if we were picking up a passenger from one strip and we knew that we were in adverse weather conditions at that strip, we would ask him if he would go to one round the corner, maybe about another a mile or so away, where the sort of, where the strip was completely into wind, and we could then land and take off without too much worry. But that was quite a problem at certain times of the year, was this very heavy wind which blew right across one of our strips.
Did you have any losses of aircraft or damage to aircraft through accident while you were in Wales?
No, we had one or two minor accidents in Wales. There was one, I remember, right at the very end of our training time. One of the sergeant pilots was taking off a very tricky strip in a field, which was just an ordinary sort of pasture, got airborne all right, but had us fly between two trees at the far end of the strip and just drifted slightly and caught one of the trees. Fortunately, he didn't suffer any real damage himself. I think it was a bit of a bruise, but the aircraft was written off, I'm afraid, so we had to go to Korea, less one aircraft, but a replacement soon followed, as happened. There was no so great loss on that, but that was the only real so casualty we had in training.
What was the size and organisation of the flight?
The flight was organised on exactly the same establishment as an Aero P flight, except that the pilots in an Aero P flight were all Aero P trained and were all gunner officers. There were no NCO pilots. In the case of the glider pilot regiment, or the light liaison flight, which was glider pilot regiment, we had two officers, myself as the flight commander, another captain as the second in command of the flight, and six NCO pilots. Who were all glider pilots at that time, all glider pilot trained. And then I had half the flight, about 18 soldiers who were responsible for driving vehicles and for working the radios and doing sort of general admin in the flight. And then about 20 airmen and NCOs who were entirely responsible for the maintenance of the aircraft. And that was quite a tricky business in Korea, carrying out some maintenance in the forward areas, particularly in adverse weather conditions. But the RAF chaps I had were extremely good.
Were all your soldiers regulars?
No. They, of the ground crew, and similarly some of the RAF, but most of the ground crew were national service. They'd been drawn largely from Royal Armoured Corps regiments, so there's a complete mixture of cap badges there initially. And the reason we drew them from the Armoured Corps regiments was because we wanted chaps who could work 62 sets and 19 sets, which were our sort of tactical communications, and also to be able to drive vehicles. And most of those chaps were national service, and they did an extremely good job. On the RAF side, because of their sort of long training and technical training that they had to have, they were at least short service, and some of them were regular Royal Air Force. And very skilled they were, too, in their own trades. I had all the sort of various trades which were applicable to sort of that type of aircraft. One flight sergeant who was responsible entirely for the maintenance of the aircraft and also for assembling them in Japan, when we took them out on the boat and we offloaded in Japan, assembled the aircraft there, and then was responsible for the maintenance in the field. So we had engine mechanics, airframe mechanics, instrument mechanics, electric mechanics, and there were one or two others, in fact, who came into it, including cooks and so forth, and administrators. But I think of all those chaps we had, most of them, in fact, were regulars.
Was the discipline in the flight formal, or was it run on a less formal basis than it would have been if it were an infantry company, for example?
Yes, an interesting point, this, because with it being such a mixture of cap badges, not least Royal Air Force blue with the Royal Air Force badge, in one part of the flight, and a mixture of cavalry regiments and sort of one or two infantry regiments, all mixed up in the sort of in the army personnel of the ground crew, and of course the glider pilots themselves with their own sort of red berets and glider pilot badges. That at first I was a little bit apprehensive as to how we would shake down and sort of fit together, but there was little doubt about it that by the time we'd finished our training, that everyone knew each other very well, and I then was able to put all, with the permission of the various colonels of regiments, was able to put all my army ground crew into red berets with the glider pilot badge. So then we only had two badges to contend with, Royal Air Force and glider pilot regiment. I made a point of ensuring that we were recognised as being a Royal Air Force flight, and it was called 1913, Light Liaison, in brackets, Light Liaison Flight, Royal Air Force. We flew the Royal Air Force standard at the end of our trip outside the flight office, and we had to make our returns direct to Hong Kong. We were inspected quite often by some Royal Air Force officers coming out from group headquarters, I think it probably was at Hong Kong, and I used to then apply to my Royal Air Force chaps, if they were being disciplined, the Royal Air Force Act, and in the case of the soldiers, I applied the Army Act. But discipline was good, I think, thanks to two very good NCOs who I had, one flight sergeant who was absolutely meticulous so far as his airmen were concerned in the maintenance of the aircraft, and I never had any worry on that side, and that is always the biggest worry, I think, where you've got a technical arm, that people will carry out their sort of servicing and their actual performance properly. And on the Army side, I had a very good staff sergeant there who looked after sort of the general discipline, including the airmen as well, from the point of view of turnout and everything else. And I would like to think that the flight I had, despite the fact that it was a complete mixture, was well disciplined. I never had any sort of serious problems. I think the only thing I ever had was a chap who went out on a spree on one occasion with a jeep and wrote it off, and I'm afraid I had to sort of take fairly strong disciplinary action against him. But otherwise, no, there was very little crime, or very little, even in the way of minor offences in the flight. The main problem was, of course, you couldn't really discipline the chap in the field, and this was applicable to other units in the forward areas in Korea, that to give them a minor punishment, you couldn't really confine them to barracks. There was very little to be gained by sort of depriving them of any privileges. The only thing which you could really go for, and that was a big punishment, was to send them back to the field punishment centre. I think it was back at Kure, where a chap would then go back and be literally sort of put in detention for 28 days, whatever it might be. But I never had to do that, except for this one case of the chap writing a vehicle off. He was sent back to Kure, and there he stayed for 28 days and eventually came back to me, I hope, a wiser man.
Presumably one of the difficulties of sending people back was that you lost them for a month or so.
That's right. Yes, this again was a problem which affected other units, and of course was applicable, I think, also in the last war, and certainly in the First World War, that quite often to send a chap back to a detention centre, more or less putting him in jail for a month or sort of 56 days as a result of a court-martial, whatever it might be, that for some of them was almost a merciful release for getting out of sort of the discomfort of a battle area. And when you were in a small unit, you could ill afford to lose a chap who was technically trained or who was a kingpin in some particular team. He might be a sort of radio operator, he might be a driver, but to lose that chap, even for 28 days, was a severe handicap for the others. Somebody had to double up for him.
How long did it take to develop a sense of unit solidarity and esprit de corps?
When we were back in training in Wales and Middle Wallop, it remained a slightly split flight for a time. The Army used to sort of rather sort of pull the RAF's legs, and the RAF were a bit sensitive and used to respond, perhaps by criticising the Army and the various regiments and sort of in the best way they knew how. But anyway, it was friendly rivalry, but I was always conscious of the fact that they were working almost as two parts of the team. But the time that it suddenly came together was when we first came into operation in the forward area alongside the Imjin, which was only about at that particular point where we were moving forward, actually, up behind a battle. And we'd moved into a new strip, and we came under some mortar fire coming over from the enemy lines. Or at least it might have been artillery fire, but anyway, it was started to fall fairly close to us on the other side of the Imjin. I'd already sort of given instructions as soon as we arrived there that everyone would dig slit trenches. They were properly sighted, tactically sighted, from the point of view of defence, ground defence, if we in fact should have anyone sort of carrying out an attack on the strip, but more particularly from the point of view of being able to, soldiers and airmen being able to protect themselves against air attack, but more particularly artillery and mortar attack. At that stage, the slit trenches had been well and truly dug by all the soldiers who knew how to dig them. The RAF chaps were not so keen on sort of digging ground, digging some pretty solid and pretty stony ground too. And it never really had been told to do this before. There was a certain amount of reluctance. But as soon as these first shots fell within 200 yards of the strip, I've never seen Japs blue and khaki digging like mad. And from then onwards, the flight became very much a cohesive unit where everyone suddenly realized they were reliant on each other. And I never looked back after that. It all worked very well.
Now, you mentioned the outbreak of the Korean War, 1950. Did that come as a surprise to you?
Yes, I think it did, in a way, because I was somewhat removed from it at that time, and certainly most of the soldiers, I think, had no idea what it really entailed. I'd been flying aircraft on the Berlin airlift in 48, 49, and then suddenly started to realize what the communist threat really meant, particularly so far as Berlin was concerned, of course, but also I was aware of the fact that the communist influence was then sort of spreading to the Far East. I'd seen a bit of it while I'd been in Malaya at the very end of the war, and it was obviously then starting to boil up there in Malaya. It was starting to boil up in other sort of countries. But the one thing which we had not anticipated was quite such a sweeping defeat of the American force, United Nations forces, in Korea itself. And this certainly came home to one, that that communism, particularly Chinese communism, was really on the march, and one took a very close interest in it as soon as the war started. And in fact, I was asked whether I would like to go to Korea. I wasn't ordered to go. I was asked if I would take the flight. I was a regular officer by that stage. I'd converted from a wartime commission, emergency commission, to a regular commission. And I said, yes, I would. I was very keen to go. So I then became extremely interested in it. But from the point of view of the soldiers, it was always very difficult to get this across to them, exactly why they were there and what they were doing in this country, right around the other side of the world, fighting a war which they really didn't understand. Those who had been involved in the last war, in the 39-45 war, at least knew who their enemy was and what the threat was. But to try and sort of educate the soldiers, and quite often I'm afraid some of the young National Service officers, as I found in some of the other units, very difficult to get the message across. But I think that they now, of course, looking back on it and seeing the sort of state of South Korea and the affluence of South Korea, it was fairly obvious that the fight against communism in that war was worthwhile.
How did you go about trying to educate your soldiers? Was there a policy of keeping them in the picture in the way that Montgomery used to do in Northwest Europe?
Yes. I don't know quite how it worked with the forward units. I think most of their briefing was done perhaps when they came into reserve as a reserve company or came back into a rest centre. But I used to have a parade more or less every day to give them sort of an up-to-date situation on any battle that had taken place, particularly if there had been activity on the front. Tell them what happened last night, what was happening during the day, and give them a fairly detailed brief on the Commonwealth Division front. But from the point of view of the sort of the whole army front, from west coast to east coast, I would try and sort of get a full brief on that and give them a sort of a sit-down lecture about once every 10 days or so, and sometimes bring in another speaker, perhaps, from divisional headquarters to come down and talk to them and give them a full brief exactly what was happening. In addition to which, of course, it was also essential to give them